Hello, and welcome to Reimagining with Rage On. My name is Heather Smith, and I'm the Executive Director of Rage On ShareCare, a small registered Canadian charity working in partnership with communities in Haiti and the Dominican Republic to reach their goals in sustainable development and social justice. News reports about Haiti in 2023 have not been positive, at least not those reports that reach the ears of most Canadians. Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated in July of 2021. Crisis and chaos have ensued, characterized by political instability, escalating gang violence, growing food insecurity, and alarming humanitarian conditions. Today, there are no democratically elected officials in Haiti, as the current government led by Prime Minister Ariel Henry has been unable to garner the support of opposition groups or even the general public who have not been afforded their right to vote in organized elections. Criminal gangs with political connections were said to control about 80% of the capital of Port-au-Prince, where they reign through terror. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights reported more than 3,900 people killed and nearly 3,000 kidnapped in gang-related violence in Haiti in 2023 alone. The violence has expanded to other regions and continues to greatly disrupt safe travel and trade. The UN also estimates that 5.2 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance, and 2 out of 5 Haitians face acute food insecurity. So here at Rage On ShareCare, people often ask us for more information about what's really happening in Haiti. They want to know if it's safe for us to work there, if our partners are able to achieve any progress, what hopes we have for the future. They wonder, how are average Haitians surviving? What path forward exists for Haiti to rise above the crisis and claim her right to a brighter future? Today, we're very lucky to be joined by 3 special guests, each bringing a unique perspective. Dr. Myriam J.A. Chancy is a Haitian-Canadian-American writer and acclaimed national and international speaker, delivering talks and creative readings on the subject of Caribbean, Haitian, and social justice issues. She's a Guggenheim Fellow and HBA Chair of the Humanities at Scripps College. Her 2021 novel on the 2010 earthquake, What Storm, What Thunder, received star reviews and numerous coveted awards, including being named a best book of 2021 by NPR, Kirkus, Boston Globe, Amazon Books, and Canada's Globe and Mail, among others. She has authored influential books of literary criticism and is regarded as an expert in Afro-Caribbean women's literature. Also joining us today, we have Gabrielle Lauzon, celebrated writer, poet, speaker, and painter. Described as a specialist in laughter, he loves teaching and inspiring people. Gabrielle also was born in Port-au-Prince, today makes his home in Toronto, Canada. In addition to his many artistic pursuits, Gabrielle consults in organizational development, is a frequent conference speaker, and is very involved in the Canadian Francophone community, hosting a weekly radio show, Franco Découverte, in Toronto, CHOQ-FM 105.1. He's passionate about ecology and sits on the board of directors of the Trees That Feed Foundation, one of Rage On's partners doing tremendous work in Haiti. And last but not least, we're joined by my dear colleague, Renaud Thomas. Renaud was born in the rural district of Jacmel and helped his family with farming and animal husbandry until he moved to Port-au-Prince to finish high school and study at the Faculty of Agronomy and Veterinary Medicine at the Haitian State University of Damien. After graduation, Renaud entered the nonprofit world, recruited by American charity Women and Children's Hope Foundation. Later, he specialized in permaculture design, eventually going on to create and manage permaculture programs at Haitian universities. He's been director of Rage On ShareCare Haiti's work since 2018, where he oversees programs in education, healthcare, agriculture, and the empowerment of women. So a very warm welcome to each of you. It's truly an honor to have you join me in this virtual studio today. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Perhaps each of you could just tell a little bit about what you're currently working on. Myriam, why don't we start with you?
Oh, sure. Well, first, thank you very much for having us here for this conversation. I'm looking forward to listening as much as contributing. I have a book out now called Harvesting Haiti that you can see behind me, which are my collected essays on the post-earthquake situation, especially looking at women's issues, but also on the tensions with the Dominican Republic, which is something that has resurged more recently. And I'm also, you know, working, I have another novel coming out, which also looks at the DR-Haiti divide, but from a more personal point of view, which I know we'll be talking a little bit about today, which is the role of fiction or art in conveying more information about Haiti to others. So I think I'll just say that to start.
And Gabriel?
I am currently working on a book on Suzanne Louverture, which was Toussaint's wife, their deportation from Saint-Domingue in 1802 to France. So the book should be out hopefully by this fall, maybe earlier, but I think that's what we're aiming for. I'm also currently working on two other novels, one that's Bring Me Back to Haiti, and another one that talks about like a little bit more of my, not so much my life, but a life in Toronto.
Wow. So we have multiple new releases to look forward to. That's awesome. And Renaud, tell us a little bit more about what you're working on in Haiti.
As the program director for Region in Haiti, actually we work focuses on a mountain of sustainable development. Actually, we work with a women federation that gathers more than 350 members and over eight areas, or eight communities. And we do like a loan community business, like corn mills, rice mills, and we do tree nursery, breadfruit processing, and women leadership training in adult literacy and so on.
So we have some diverse perspectives here, and I really want to be able to dive right into some deep discussion with you all. So I'd mentioned earlier, official news that about Haiti that reaches Canadians tends to be rather shocking and negative, often woefully lacking in any sort of historical context. We see these images of Haitians protesting in the streets, or we hear reports of gang terror, and you know that description of Haiti as a quote-unquote failed state just is replayed over and over. So our conversation today is not attempting to gloss over realities of injustice and suffering that are happening, but we do hope to fill in some of the gaps in understanding that Canadians might have about what's really happening in Haiti and what hope there is for rebuilding. I'd like to start with you, Renaud, because while you were here in Canada back in September, you had very different stories to share with Canadian audiences. And I think some of the things you had to say were surprising to many of our supporters. I'm going to quote from something you said in conversation with Gabriel on his radio show. You said, "When we talk about Haiti, we talk about Port-au-Prince. So it is true that things in Port-au-Prince are not going well, but in the other department, things are better. We cannot reduce Haiti to one-tenth of its area. 90% of Haiti is doing well." Can you explain what you mean by that and what to you is so different in other areas of Haiti?
So when you look at international news or papers, all the time they're talking about Haiti, they just refer to Port-au-Prince. Why Port-au-Prince is not Haiti. So Haiti is 10 districts. We call them departments. For example, equal to Port-au-Prince, we could mention Jeremy, Lekai, Chatmel, Miragwan, Léogâne, Inch, Cap-Haïtien, and so on. Port-au-Prince is really important in Haiti for many reasons. We have almost everything concentrated in Port-au-Prince. Airport, like electricity, healthcare, universities, the port, internet, and other basic services. But outside of Port-au-Prince and the other villages that I mentioned, things are very beautiful too, like beautiful ocean, there are agriculture, a lot of food, and a beautiful place, sanitation. And most of all, you can really get in touch with the real Haitian, the Haitian culture. That's where you're going to really know who is the real Haitian. So Port-au-Prince is not Haiti.
Not the whole story. Okay. And Gabrielle Miriam, do you have any comments that you'd like to add?
Well, as a Port-au-Principian, I have to agree and disagree in a sense that I completely agree that there's an overemphasis on Port-au-Prince, you know, for different reasons. because it is the capital, it is the center of so many things. And of course, it's one of the reasons, you know, the earthquake was so devastating in 2010 because of the oversaturation of people, you know, in the capital seeking work, seeking opportunity. And so there is a distortion of what is truly Haiti in this sense. On the other hand, I would say that we can't deny that there are millions of people residing in Haiti, you know, a sort of an overpopulation that is in Port-au-Prince. And so we shouldn't neglect that some of the harms that are you know, happening to people on the ground are disproportionately happening in Port-au-Prince. And therefore, we can't completely ignore, we can't say that Port-au-Prince is not Haiti. It's part of what is happening and is part of the destabilization of a country, right? So if we think more largely about why these things are happening in Port-au-Prince and how they're being created by external forces, you know, that are acting on internal populations, both in terms of how people are being militarized on the ground, you know, how, where those supplies are coming from, and the people who are victims of that militarization. So I think there's a politicized nature to what is happening in the capital that we need to pay some attention to in order to then understand why these things are not happening, as Renaud is saying, outside the capital, where, you know, daily life is going on in a way that's not under fire, not under attack. So these things are happening at the same time. And so but I'm also thinking about the millions of people who are in some ways, you know, under fire in the capital, and that we should not forget about them, because I think that can also happen if we say, well, let's not think about Port-au-Prince, then we forget about those people who are still awaiting our assistance. So I'd like to nuance that a little bit.
I would echo a little bit both of you, because we need definitely to think about the people that are under siege, really, basically, and held hostage, cutting literally the country in three parts, because you can't travel from the south to the north, because, like, you have to go through the gangs in Martissant, then the gangs in Croix de Bouquet, so, and the people from the north can come. So therefore, there's a large limitation in terms of movement of people and movement of merchandise throughout the country. That said, and I agree with with what Winnie was saying, because there are great universities outside of Port-au-Prince. When we look at what's happening in Cap, there are also good hospitals. However, the distribution, the medical distribution is quite poor. There's not enough doctors in the outskirts, like when you live in Port-au-Prince. Let's say, I know, like, the great hospital in Jérémie, but they lack of the, not enough doctors, not enough medication. And this is kind of compounded, like, if you look at what's happening in Port-au-Prince. If we could free up a little bit of Port-au-Prince, then the rest of the country also, like, we could breathe a little easier.
You're touching on some of the specific challenges that exist, even far removed from the capital, as direct results of what's happening within Port-au-Prince. So I'm wondering if each of you can list some of the other challenges, things that you're seeing that are the biggest challenges that are facing Haitians living within Haiti right now.
The major problem is, of course, food security or food insecurity all across the country. For many reasons, since about 2 months now, there are a lot of exchanges between the DR and Haiti. I'm not saying this is good, but at least from a supply perspective, that's creating a lot of problems for the people in Haiti. However, from what I've been seeing over the past few months also, there's a new solidarity that seems to be stemming from the issues with the DR. And also, like, some of the people within the country said, oh, now it's time for us to take control of our own destiny. Let's see all of the stuff that we produce. How can we make it move out a little bit more freely throughout the country rather than relying solely on the goods coming from the DR? And suddenly people realize, gee, like, we have a lot of things to offer as well.
Okay. And Renaud, your team working in partnership with a rural women's federation has faced some big challenges in sourcing equipment and supplies that are needed to move initiatives forward. Could you explain that a little bit for our listeners and maybe comment on what is different from in the past for rural families in terms of safety and their ability to do regular business in the marketplace or to travel from place to place?
Yes. Here, to survive in the middle of the crisis, we develop what we call community strategies or community development. Community development is not something that easy to understand because it comes from the reality we live in. Like how people can survive without gas, how people can survive without electricity. What do people do when we can't travel to any location? All of those things just make of creative, like we create solutions to survive in the middle of it. One thing that teach us is what is the most important to have, you know, if there's nothing, like in the middle of the crisis, people need drinking water, they need food, you know, they need a house to stay. And because of that, they kind of lead them to, firstly, like a leadership, how they can gather and to discuss about the real problems and propose or recommend solutions together. This is why they now have community-wise and con meals. That helped a lot when they can't go to Port-au-Prince or any elsewhere to get food. People can bring their corn or rice and just, you know, organize within the community. So they help each other. People come together and say, okay, what can we do there? And, you know, together they decide, okay, we're going to use mules. We're going to use some wheelbarrow. We're going to carry some on our heads. Or there's different technique and strategy they develop, but those strategies and techniques are not written in books. Nobody can teach them. That the complexity you all live in will teach us that. And when we use that, we realize that, oh, they are really effective and nonstop. We continue to do all business during the crisis. Most of them in the past going to Port-au-Prince to buy supply and we sell in Saint-Marc or buy from Saint-Marc to sell in Port-au-Prince. But now they can't do that because of, you know, all the problem on the road. What they do is, okay, we're going to shift. We're going to do animal husbandry. We're going to do chicken. We're going to do goats. And they don't have any problems to repay the loans. And all of those things is not something we teach them. It just comes from the reality, from the community, and they teach us and we learn day by day.
Mm, so you're talking about really localized solutions to a very complex and difficult situation. To our listeners, if you haven't yet read Myriam's 2021 novel, What Storm, What Thunder, please do. It's beautiful. It's haunting, a very eye-opening novel. But it explores how consequences of the 2010 earthquake reverberate into the present. So following what Renaud was describing in terms of communities responding to a crisis like that, like the earthquake, Myriam, I'm wondering, are you seeing parallels today in Haiti?
Yeah, actually, as Gabrielle was speaking about, you know, what he's seeing on the ground and people wanting to turn to their own production, right, their own foodstuffs production, that's something that happened in the immediate aftermath of the first earthquake in 2010 as well. For a good 6-month period, people on the ground were saying, we can feed ourselves, we can produce for the country. And in fact, they did. There was no other choice, right? Because very little was coming from the outside. But people thought, well, this will be an opportunity for Haitians to demonstrate their capacities for feeding the country, for creating their own infrastructures. And of course, that was destroyed about 6 months in when foodstuffs were brought freely into the country and kind of dumped into the marketplaces, which also drove up the prices of local products and continued creating difficulties for small producers. The desire to produce for oneself is also what precipitated the denationalization of Dominicans of Haitian descent in 2013, when the government in the summer of 2013 decided that Haiti, for example, would produce its own eggs and stop importing eggs from the Dominican Republic. That apparently was the first domino that fell in what then became the denationalization process, because the DR actually makes a lot of money from exporting to Haiti, which is its chief consumer. I mean, it's interesting because also listening to Renaud, I was thinking about the traditional concept of a combite, you know, which is, the idea of a community putting all of its resources, you know, pooling its resources in order to make sure that everyone is taken care of. So when we talk about lack of infrastructure in Haiti, we're usually talking about large things like governmental structures, educational structures. But there are actually concepts as to how to organize for the better good, for the, you know, for the greater good. And these concepts, if they were to actually be incorporated into the superstructures, would result in a really viable society, because people do know how to do for themselves, but there's a constant interruption of those systems.
A note on the Haitian Creole, combite refers to a cooperative collective process of coming together to achieve a task made possible by teamwork.
This is quite interesting, all this concept of combite, because we have two recent examples. After the recent earthquake in the south, in outside of Camp Perrin, the dam that was feeding the city, the whole community, burst. So we saw people with their bare hands decided to rebuild the it's not so much a canal, but then we build a conduit that will bring the water to the city. And like without help from anyone else, from the government or whatsoever, all the communities got together, and with the help of Haiti Future down in the south, with providing some money to be able to buy some conduits and things like that. But they basically did, it was 10 to 20 kilometers of pipelines to bring the water in. And recently we saw some great show of solidarity in the north, where the people in Waname decided to build this big canal on the Massacre River, and where people get together and literally on their own, engineers, merchants, and what have you, to help put their shoulder to the task and build this canal.
Renaud, do you have similar examples of that concept of combite in the St. Mark area?
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that people do to encourage each other when they're doing like a local community walks is that they sing. It's kind of energy. When they just sing it, all people are motivated, encouraged to do more and more. And if you just take a look at the canal, the project canal, some people just come to sing. And one day just sing. That is like really investment that bring more strength to what they're doing. You know, inside of us as Haitian, and we do know that, and people like foreigners don't know those things.
I'd like to connect a little bit of this back to fiction. I know that for me personally, reading fiction about Haiti, and in particular reading Miriam's work and Gabrielle's work, has helped me to understand Haiti and perhaps the Haitian people that I work with in a deeper way. Miriam, when What Storm, What Thunder came out, you did a book talk for Rayjean at that time. And in conversation, you were speaking about how fiction can allow readers to reach into empathy that maybe they wouldn't feel by just hearing, you know, news reports of the numbers of people affected by X catastrophe, for example. So I believe you have a passage for us to share.
Yeah, I think I'll read just a couple of paragraphs from the opening section of the novel, which is in the voice of Malou, who is a market woman. And I chose to, so the novel is in 10 voices of characters from different backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, different ages, different genders, just to capture the effects of the earthquake across, you know, social strata in Haiti. But I wanted to begin and end the novel with a market woman, because if you remember back to the period just after the earthquake, you know, Time magazine, all kinds of media would use the image of a market woman or a woman walking, you know, with large loads on her head through debris as a kind of emblem of, you know, the resilience, you know, quote unquote, of Haitians. But there, I never heard anyone interview those women as to what they thought about, you know, the rebuilding of the nation, what would come next. And in fact, women by and large were left out of conversations about rebuilding. And so, and I'm also the great-granddaughter of a market woman who, you know, made my mother's life possible. And so I wanted to honor market women through the voice of the market woman. And I wanted also to add to the previous conversation that I was interested in hearing that in 2019, for the first time ever across the Republic, market women organized themselves. So there's now an association of market women, of 48,000 market women who are advocating for their own rights. And I think that might also create a shift in, you know, how things are done in the future. So just a couple of paragraphs from Malou, you know, telling us what she saw or what they did. And this also speaks to the idea of a combat. Eventually, we, the market women, remembered our oil lamps and lit them one by one, those of us who could. Only part of the market had been crushed, the part against a wall. Still, it was impossible to tell what belonged to whom, and at that point, no one cared. We worked at freeing those we could, said prayers for the others, promising deliverance to those we could not get to give them some solace, some hope, in their final moments, because salvation would soon be theirs. Then back down the street, darting back and forth, using the goods from the market to feed those working at rescue, doing what we could, as we always did, our large bodies moving through the rubble as if we were land whales, made for swimming through dust-laden air, made for parting human waves. We treated everyone alike. They had become all the same, were always the same, something we had always known from our low to the ground perches, observing life like budgies, our heads wrapped in colorful scarves to keep the heat of the sun from roasting our brains, sweat slipping down our necks, draping the half moon of our chests exposed above the breasts. We fanned ourselves, but it didn't help. Chaleur, heat, came with a territory, but not this, a different kind of heat. Sitting here under the hot sun all day, we ripen. The saints, the crooks, the foreigners, the white saviors, the bleeding hearts, they all need sustenance, and we give it to them. Close my eyes, look away, it's all the same. The need to shut everything down, slow my breathing, take in what's there to take in, let all the rest go. If only I could get rid of the images of the smell still clogging my nostrils. Ha! You would think that after so many years working in the market, nothing would offend this nose. Look around what surrounds us every day. The mounds of smoldering garbage, the spoiling fruits with skins speckled with loitering flies, the leavings of dogs, the runoff of dirty water weaving its way through the alleyways. A marketplace is a world of colliding senses, not all of it pretty or fruitful, much of it decay, especially at the end of a day when the best of what's available is gone and all that remains are cast-offs, the leftovers. This is the part of the day when those of us who work the market blend into the dust and the loam, become one with the elements, the odors of sweat and dung, the sweet sap of fleshy fruits ground underfoot, the nothing that we are, the all. We sweep up what's left of a day, knowing that striving toward perfection is beyond our reach.
Wow.
Thank you. The heat, the colliding of the senses, it's just a completely different image. I'm almost like picking dust out of my eyes, you know, it makes it that real to us. Gabrielle, what deeper understanding do you hope that Canadians will gain through reading your writing and perhaps listening to this conversation today? Just before we hear Gabrielle's response to my question, we need an explanation of a Haitian Creole word, restavek, which refers to a Haitian child who has been committed to work for a wealthier household as a domestic servant because their parents lack the resources to otherwise support their well-being. The word comes from the French, rester avec, to stay with. The practice meets international definitions of child trafficking, and despite its official abolishment in 2003, an estimated 300,000 Haitian children are still affected. Gabrielle's 2017 novel, Hubert le Reste Avec, tells the gut-wrenching tale of one such child.
That's a little bit like Miriam said. To me, fiction is truth, and truth is fiction. Through the eyes of both Hubert, the Reste Avec, you can see an analysis of the whole society in Haiti, the poor people, the rich folks, the differences between the people from the countryside or the way of living and the people in the capital. And so when people read that, I want them to be able to understand the root cause of the phenomenon of Reste Avec in Haiti. And this is poverty and lack of access to education, lack of access to work that forced the parents to give their children away. And but also at the same time, want people to understand that it's not all dark, because even when Hubert was going through the worst part of his life, you can see there's still hope that he can change things himself, not waiting for someone else to do it for him. And this is what I want people to understand, that this word that we, Miriam mentioned, to tell quote-unquote resilience. I hate when they tell Asian people are resilient, because to me it's more than a resilience. There's a force of character that the people brings with them. Most of the folks from the countryside, when we meet them, Renaud and I, we did a workshop outside of Jacmel many years ago. And then you can see the value that they carry. Unfortunately, a lot of those have been spoiled by people telling them, whatever you buy from the US or even from the DR, they're much better than what you can grow yourself on your soil. And kind of brainwashing people, telling them, no, this is not good. The mango juice that you can make out of your mangoes, it's better if you buy a soda from the BR. So that people get to a point where they don't see the value of what they have, thinking that it's always better to buy the spaghetti from whatever, or the US rice rather than the one from Latibonite, which was totally wiped by our dear friends. So what I want people to understand when they read the books, it's so that they are other things that they need to understand about Haiti. But also like on the other book, for people to know the sacrifice that some of the young people did in 1962 when they decided to go back to Haiti and to overthrow the Duvalier's regime, and all of them were killed. And I'd like to read maybe the last few words where before they were killed by the two friends that were captured alive, and Duvalier decided to make an example of them and killed them on the side of the cemetery, Port-au-Prince Cemetery. So the original of the book is in French, and I'm going to read the English translation for you. The two prisoners were woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning and forcibly taken away from their jail cell. Asleep, only a few of their fellow prisoners realized what was going on. They were shaved and had their hair cut. Then they were dragged into the showers. Jacques, what do you think will happen to us? I'm not sure, but there have been rumors that we'll be shot. It might happen today. Stay strong. You too. Shut up, shouted one of the guards. What else can you possibly do to us? Replied Jack. You were so brave, Henri. I would have hoped for a different ending to this adventure. Me too. Imagine a triumphant entry into Jérémie. Henri was allowed a white shirt with short sleeves, still too small for him despite all the deprivations, a black jeans, and a pair of sneakers. Jacques was given military clothes and the same shoes. They were taken to the refectory and served a generous meal. Neither Jacques nor Henri touched their plates. "Eat," said the officer. "It's your last meal." Jacques and Henri smiled. They raised their fist and shouted, "Venceremos. Hasta la victoria siempre." "The day will come where the revolution will finally win," added Henri.
Thank you for taking us into that little piece of history. It's difficult to listen to, but it shows us things that again, are often missing in the narrative. Both Myriam and Gabrielle's writing in different ways convey stories of horrendous violence and abuse, highlighting aspects of Haitian history that have been largely unheard or even deliberately silenced in the West. Renaud, during his Canadian tour, delivered multiple presentations about key events in Haitian history that Canadians are often not aware of. So, Renaud, I'd like to ask you to share just one of those key moments in Haitian history that you think Canadians might not understand well, and let us know about its importance to you.
To understand what's happening in Haiti for the moment, I think a look at our history is important. For example, where Haiti come from? Most people know that we came from slavery. So from 1503 to 1803, it was 3 centuries of slavery. 1804, that nation decided to organize the revolution and fight for their freedom. Our oppressor did not agree to that. But for many years, France claimed to recognize the independence of Haiti. We have to pay a debt. It's like we abused the France, you know, we killed the foreigners, you know, the masters. So we have to pay a debt. At that time, Haiti didn't have the amount of money they claimed as a debt for the independence. So they have to sign an agreement and to continue to work again to pay back to France as debt for the independence of Haiti. That was 1825. So another big moment is 1860, when Vatican, we call that Saint-Siège, to recognize Haiti as a free nation. We had to sign an agreement where we denied Haitian culture, which is voodoo. And now all Haitian has to be like Protestant or Catholic. Otherwise, they would not recognize Haiti as a free nation. And it was not a choice. That was not optional. So the president signed that agreement, and then they persecute all Haitians that were like voodoo priests, women or men, and they have to hide themselves in the mountain, and it's become like a shame to tell people that you are voodooism, like you practice like voodoo as culture. And until today, even voodoo, you know, in salvation, but it's like a shame if you present yourself as a voodooism. And the fourth big moment is the American occupation that comes from 1915 to 1934. So again, the United States, they just said that we are not capable to lead ourselves. There's too many trouble, we not strong nation, we weak. They come back and control all the things, the banks, school, university, and the churches. Everything just comes from the United States again. It's like a kind of the way it abuses the nation. They took all the thing, they destroyed the Haitian culture, they you know, manipulated all the leaders, Asian leaders, you know, and they make like someone who don't really know who we are. Are we American? Are we Asian? Are we African? We don't really know, because become a real Haitian is like a shame in the country. And now I think we need to go back and try to identify ourselves as Asian and teach other people to be Haitian. I think that's where will come from the solution.
This destruction of cultural identity is repeated in history through the process of colonization at the hands of European and North American colonizers. Myriam and Gabrielle, how do you think these events reverberate in Haiti today?
Well, I think where I would pick up is that I think all of the events that Renaud inventoried are, you know, really important moments throughout our history. And we can't understand what's happening now without having understood what happened then and how the actors in these historical moments, whether it's the U.S. or France, you know, or indeed Canada, which is often involved, you know, in some of these interventions, are still the main actors in terms of the international community in Haiti today. And I think one of the things I'd like to signal is, you know, we haven't talked as much about gender, but women have been key actors at many of these moments, but often denied a voice. So, for example, it was under the U.S. occupation that women novelists started writing in response to the occupation, in response to, you know, the violation of women under the occupation. And then even more women started producing under the Duvalier regime, you know, which is more recent history, from 1957 to 1986. And then, you know, after the first freely elected president in the early 90s was, deposed through a coup in 1991, there was a rise in violence, politically motivated violence against women. And we also know that many women leaders perished in the earthquake of 2010, and it took some years for them to be able to build back. But even so, you know, in the early 2000s, women worked to make sure that there were more women's rights respected in the Constitution. But these are things that are still not enacted today. So we have not seen freely held elections for a very long time in Haiti, but certainly not in the last several years. And there is a amendment to the Constitution whereby 30% of elected officials in Haiti are supposed to be women. And if there are no elections being held, then those women cannot gain representation. So I guess I would like to signal that we need to work towards more inclusivity in terms of gender parity as we move forward. And for Canadians, they need to be aware that Canada does act on behalf of, you know, whether it's the UN or the US in Haiti in ways that sometimes Canadians are unaware of.
I agree with Myriam Hold heartedly. Women have been denied their place in history in Haiti. From all the women that fought for the independence, they were never recognized. Very few of them signed the Act of Independence. Although they were up in the forefront of the battles with Toussaint, and a lot of the women. That's what I found while researching Suzanne. She was a very strong person, and without her, Toussaint would have never been the leader that he was, because she was the one holding the fort, manning the Toussaint's plantation while he was fighting. And although, like, she has never had a place in history for her role. And growing up, I saw my mother, like, raised us like seven kids all by herself, without a father present. And the women in Haiti are the potomitan, like the backbone of the country. They're the one that's out at the markets every day. The economy will not be what it is without the contribution of all the women in the country.
I'm glad you both have talked about the role of women in Haiti in shaping the history, the present, the future, and specifically for speaking to what needs to change in order to ensure that their voices are heard. Renaud, I wonder if you could take us right into the present to something that's happening with the incredible group of more than 350 women you are working with in the Haitian Women's Federation in the rural St. Mark area.
How we work with the women in St. Mark is that we firstly recognize that the importance of women, and also the women themselves know they are important. We kind of sit together. We start by discussing that, and they tell us about their situation within the family, whether violence, economic problems, all those things. We really learn from them, and after that, we together do recommendation. And now there are a lot of trainings about women leadership, about whether economy, gender equity, and anything that they find important to them. We can work together and we do that. And the next step was like economic situation. This is why together we create like a microcredit program, and they just manage it. We just assist. And now they become like a kind of corporation that gather many, many like villages, and all the villages come day to day to join, and what they learn, they pass to other community. That means they pass to other women in other villages. They continue to grow every day, every day.
I'd like to give a shout out to partners like PWRDF and Trees That Feed Foundation that are standing with the Haitian Women's Federation in solidarity through their financial support. Partnership matters, but it also matters that it's not done in a top-down manner, but that it's truly being led by the voices and the direction of Haitian leaders, with support from international partners who come alongside for a time. What do you three think Canadians can do, from individuals to organizations to our government, to make sure that it's Haitian-driven change?
One thing is, like we've noticed over the past few years, I'm working also with a group in the north through a nonprofit organization called NULA, which has been working with the a group of coffee planters in the north towards the border with the Dominican Republic. And I would say maybe 75%, if not more, of the coffee planters are women. But what we need is for those voices to be recognized not only within Haiti, but also outside of the country. But what we need is for Haitian-led groups to emerge rather than looking towards outsiders. Not the outsiders are not necessary, like Region is necessary, Trees That Feed is necessary, but they need to give the leadership to the people on the ground.
Yeah, I would add that, you know, of course, Canadians should support, you know, organizations like Région, and there are other organizations based in Canada, like COMPI, which was formed right after the earthquake by Régine Chassagne and Dominique Anglade. I like to support an arts group. It's a women's art group out of La Gonave, the little island off the coast of in the mouth of Haiti, which is called Art Matenois. And so I think the first thing to do when people want to support what's happening in Haiti is they need to look to organizations that are trusted by Haitians, but also that have done longstanding work on the ground in a way that respects Haitian values, traditions, you know, whether that's the Combit concept of collectivity or, you know, supporting people who are working at the grassroots, who are vaudouisant, you know, that really truly respect the Haitian people. And many of those organizations are there. It just takes a little work, you know, from the outside to research the organizations and know what they're about.
So by my side, I would say like, we can see a lot of investment or a lot of funds spend in Haiti, but that not resolve the problems. So any people that working in Haiti to reverse the situation, I would suggest that they listen to the community where they are working. They just know that it's not only about the money they have, but the input the local have really import, it matters a lot if they want to do the real change.
As we begin to wrap up our conversation, I want to ask each of you, what is it that gives you hope for the future of Haiti? Where are you finding that hope?
Well, I'd like to say that when I see so many artists, you know, writers, painters, you know, producing still within Haiti, and, you know, in the diaspora, like myself and Gabrielle, that gives me hope. But the production is quite high, even within Haiti. I know there's also theater and arts organizations, both in Port-au-Prince and in Cap-Haïtien, that are training younger people who want to express themselves in the art. And I heard recently from people like Yannick Laens, who is in Port-au-Prince still, that when they run these workshops for young people, they are dominated by young girls and women who have a lot of hope and, you know, a lot of vision for the future of the country. Seeing the market women organize, you know, in such large numbers in recent years, that gives me hope. There is no way, you know, when we see all of this production, grassroots movements, women getting involved, young people, people combating, you know, armed gangs and so forth in the streets, that you can not have hope. I mean, that's, as somebody who lives outside of Haiti at this time, that's what keeps me going and keeps me talking about Haiti and having hope for the future, even when it seems like the situation is hopeless.
What I'm seeing is as positive is the number of young people in Haiti. More than half of the population is under 30. So I believe there's a lot of good things that can come out of that, providing that they give them a way to express themselves. I agree with the Miriam in terms of what's happening in the arts. And it's wonderful to see, despite all the turmoil, despite all the hardships, that young university students are pulling together to teach other students, because there have been no school for the past, I don't know how many months now, I know. So those are the kind of things, like, it's, again, we talk about combat earlier. We talk about, we didn't touch more on the concept of the laku, but that's people getting together and taking control of their own destiny.
The first thing is like the solidarity in the community themselves, how Haitians support Haitians to provide cares within the communities. So they know how to survive in the middle of difficulties. It's a way to say that if we just try to resolve, we have the good technique to reverse the situation naturally, it can be quickly reversed. So many good things about Haiti, but unfortunately, we only need leadership and understanding of the country itself.
Gabrielle, you mentioned the concept of laku. The concept of laku features prominently in Miriam's novel Spirit of Haiti as well. I'd like to hear, maybe Miriam, what does laku mean to you? Can you explain it for those not familiar with the term, and how might it apply to Canada-Haiti relations at this time?
Yeah, for Anglophones, you know, laku translates to yard. And so in the Anglophone Caribbean, the yard is often the space in which people make music. For example, in Trinidad, the tin pan yards where people make music. And the concept comes from the idea of a yard in African contexts, in West Africa especially, but all over the African continent, where family groups and then kinship groups would be organized around a kind of circular space that where different community happenings would take place. And in Haiti, Velaku often also becomes not just a yard space, but the voodoo gathering space. So it has all these connotations of ancestry, kinship, community, connections to one another. And in my academic work, I've expanded that notion to Velaku in terms of African diasporics, not just Haitians, but people who are connected through the African diaspora in various parts of the world, in different geographies, but all return to, you know, a source, traditions, spiritual traditions, cultural traditions that connect them to one another. And so you can think of Velaku as also being connected to the idea of a combite or the collective, you know, working for the greater good, because you have faith and belief in this connection to one another through Velaku. So for me, I guess in a kind of parting word, as somebody who is in the Haitian diaspora at this time, I think of Velaku as something that connects me back to Haiti, all parts of Haiti, you know, not just Port-au-Prince where I was born, but different parts of the communities, and wanting to work for that greater good, because I understand myself to be part of this ancestry, this community. And others can participate who are not of Haitian descent, as long as they understand and honor that history, its richness, and how much we could all learn and draw from it for, you know, more global equity, and for, you know, people in Haiti on the ground to be able to participate in their futures in a fulsome way.
I think that is probably the absolute perfect place to end with the concept of Laku, as we consider how to best stand in solidarity with Haiti at this time. I want to thank you all so much for sharing your insights about Haiti, a nation and a people who have so much to teach the world if we would listen. If you'd like to support Rajan Sharecare's work, Renaud's work, and the work of the Haitian Women's Federation Rural St. Marc, please visit our website at rajon.org. That's rayjon.org, where you can learn more about all of their incredible work. At rajon.org/podcasts, you'll also find links to Gabrielle and Miriam's websites and the organizations that they mentioned in this conversation. And don't forget to visit your local indie bookstore to pick up copies of their books. A final note on the music you're hearing now, as sung by proud members of the Haitian Women's Federation in St. Marc, Haiti, in honor of the late Camita Estevern Estime, one of the original leaders of the Federation who passed away in January of 2024. The song is testimony to the strength of Haitian women to rise again and to fight for their rights. You'll find the full lyrics in English and in Creole Haitien on our website. We dedicate this episode to her memory and to the leaders of the Haitian Women's Federation who continue her legacy today. Please keep exploring, keep learning about Haiti. Thank you. Merci en pile.